From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Movies and munchies have gone hand in hand pretty much since the origin of moving pictures. That's truer than ever these days as we watch most of our content sprawled out on our couches instead of sitting in a theater. So, welcome to our Food in Film show. Yes, we know, most movies and TV shows are shot digitally, but let's not be tediously literal. Whether it's on the big screen, the small screen, or a screen that fits in the palm of your hand, it's the intersection of cinema and cuisine that offers a buffet's worth of cultural morsels. So let's start with our first course. Imagine a world, almost like our own, but not quite, where the practice of extracting sound from food is a respected artistic discipline. Spectators show up at galleries to watch as sonic caterers capture the audio of overflowing blenders, sizzling frying pans, and microphones plunged into pudding. Sounds strange? Well, it is. The dark and exotic comedy Flux Gourmet is the weirdest movie I have seen in years. It follows an unnamed artistic collective led by the imperious LDL during a residency at an institute devoted to culinary and alimentary performance. This film isn't for all tastes, but as someone who works at the intersection of food, audio, and culture, I approve. We can thank writer and director Peter Strickland for inventing this otherworldly satire. Hi, Peter.
Hello. Hi.
This concept of sonic catering is so fabulous and far out. How did you come up with it? And why does it feel so deviant?
Actually, I was in a band that did that. We started in 1996. I think it was just a basic surrealist notion of taking something very ordinary for people in the Western world and putting it in a different context. And suddenly it forces you to listen. We were not really performing with food. We were just documenting it. And okay, we were heightening it with certain sound effects. So that was us. But I think in the film, that's more mixed in with this kind of brutal actionist performance that you would associate with people in Vienna in the 60s, like Kurt Cannan and Otto Muhl, Hermann Nietzsche, who were dealing with meat a lot more, even though it was just a vegetarian band. I guess that's where the deviant element comes in. And also that's connected to bodily fluids and so on, of course.
Sound is just, I mean, obviously I work with sound. I find sound incredibly intriguing. And I was one of those children that couldn't watch a horror movie because of the sound. So I would love to just hear more about what intrigues you about sound, given that you're in this visual medium.
I think in general, the more restricted your perspective is when it comes to your senses, the more your imagination compensates. So in a way, I feel sight is the laziest sense because everything is just done for you. I think smell is the most evocative sense. I mean, memories just come flooding back with smell. Sound is pretty close to that, as you mentioned, when watching horror films. I had the same. I remember seeing The Omen when I was too young to see it, and it was the music that really just completely destroyed me. So yeah, I think sound can really deceive you. It can play tricks on the mind. It can work against image, which I find quite interesting. And it just expresses a whole state of mind, which images can't always do.
I understand that a lot of the film's sound design came from your own performances, and then you added new material on top of that. Can you describe how the audio for the Sonic Kitchen Band that we see in the movie was created?
We use the same recipes as in the film. So the three of us, Tim Kirby, Colin Fletcher, and I would do the cooking. Tim and Colin would run it live through all pretty much the same effects as what you see in the film. Most of that gear is theirs. the copycat tape delay, the other reel-to-reel. They would just do these very long sessions, like 20-minute sessions, roughly, and we would edit them down. You chop them up, you layer them, you kind of treat them a lot like food, really. We were interested with this band to treat sound the same way you treat food and use the recipe as a kind of score.
So what were some of the dishes that you made?
Well, very simple, I'm afraid. I'm not going to win any awards. One was a tomato soup. The other one was an omelette. We didn't do the chocolate cake that was in the film. But when we do this, we have to think about what makes the best sound. Sometimes more advanced dishes don't quite work. So we try to think of sounds that involve a blender, sounds that involve sizzling and frying, boiling.
While there is a lot of dark humor in Flux Gourmet, the main characters all take their work just extremely seriously, especially L2L. She's controlling, manipulative, she's cruel. She's actually pretty toxic. What drives her? Why is she so intent on being a scion in this niche field?
Well, I guess it's me. I just like anti-heroes. I remember just watching De Niro and Taxi Driver and being kind of drawn to these deeply flawed characters. You might not want to know them in real life, but in a film, they're quite mercurial. I think it was interesting for me to look at ego, look at the power dynamics within a band. And yeah, and the idea of exploitation, where she's taking someone's very serious stomach issues and kind of piggybacking from that and using that for her work.
Yeah, you're referring to this other strong line in the movie that relates to the character of Stones, a journalist who's been hired to document this artistic collective, and through most of the film, he's suffering with intense digestive discomfort and all the embarrassment that comes with that. And then, in fact, some of his diagnostic procedures end up being part of Elle's performance. Why did you make this such a prominent storyline?
I just thought it wasn't being done in film. There might have been something, but I'm just not aware of it. And when I've seen stomach issues done, they've always been done as comedy, which, fine, whatever. But I wanted to look at something a bit with a more of a compassionate perspective, because it's so common now. We're talking about two different things. One is autoimmune issues, and the other one is allergies. And the idea of humor comes up in both. When it's revealed that Elle's character laughed at someone having anaphylaxis, which of course is no joke, but that's often presented as a joke. And it kind of ties in with the film, the idea of digestion, the idea of taboo and shock value and the function of that in art. But also this nightmarish scenario. I think a colonoscopy is bad enough, but to have it in front of an audience is like, it's a nightmare, really.
Yes, I would say total nightmare, especially when you're awake for it.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah. So Peter, what are you working on next? Do you have any plans to return to the world of food?
I do. I wouldn't call it a sequel, but I'm doing a film about celiac disease post-diagnosis. So the symptoms are a thing of the past. It's more about the social side of having a condition, especially when you're young, where fitting in is so important. Everyone having that birthday cake that you can't have. So it's like a fairy tale for kids. So, I mean, Flux Gourmet was pre-diagnosis for adults. This next film is post-diagnosis for kids. It's my first and probably only kids' film. If we make it, because who knows?
Well, I hope it does, because that is something I really want to see. Thank you so much, Peter. This was so much fun talking to you.
Thank you. No, thanks for your time. Thanks for having me.
That was filmmaker Peter Strickland, who wrote and directed the satirical horror comedy Flux Gourmet. I give it 2 thumbs up. The film came out in late June and is currently available on video on demand. Coming up, the wide world of wine stretches from Northern California to South Africa.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food, and now a little drink to go with our Food on Film show. Winemaker Tinashe Nyamuduka's tale of immigrating from Zimbabwe to South Africa is similar to the stories of countless others who have left everything behind for a chance at a more stable life. But something unusual happened once he tasted wine for the first time. He fell in love. He ended up climbing the oenology ladder, or should we say grapevine, to become one of South Africa's most respected sommeliers. Tinashe was even part of a Zimbabwean wine tasting team that competed in the 2017 and 2018 World Tasting Competition in France. The award-winning documentary Blind Ambition chronicles their dream. Hi, Tinashe.
How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm so happy you could join us.
Oh, thank you for having me as well.
Like many young men with families to support when the economic crisis hit Zimbabwe, you left for South Africa. What job did you leave behind, and what were some of the first jobs you managed to get in South Africa?
So when I left in Zimbabwe in 2008, I was working for a retail chain called TM Supermarkets, and I was a junior manager in one of the branches in my hometown, Marondera. And when I moved to South Africa, I thought I would find the same position in local retail stores. So I applied in almost all of them. And the only job I could get was a baker's position at a local spa.
So how did you end up in a position to be offered wine? How did your first interaction with it happen?
A friend I was staying with was working in restaurants, so I just applied to any restaurant I could get. There was a new restaurant opening that were looking for non-experienced people to train and teach in their program. They really had a wonderful program that they called Let's Sell Lobster. So it was pretty much teaching people with no prior experience in the hospitality industry to be successful. And that's where I really tasted my first glass of wine and really got interested with the way they were teaching us about wine.
That's so fascinating. I wish we had programs like that here. So did you take to the wine immediately, or did it take a few tries before you really fell down the rabbit hole?
It took me a while. So I figured if you're working in a restaurant, or if you ever worked in a restaurant, some of the listeners may have, to make more money, your guest check has to be higher. You get much more commission, more tips. So the only way you can do that is sell expensive wine in a restaurant. So my initial interest in wine was like really understanding how to sell the wines in the restaurant to make money. But with time, as I tasted more and I took wine from work and started drinking it at home, that's when I really fell in the rabbit hole. A couple of months after my first stint at this restaurant, I joined the one and only hotel, which was opening to a great fanfare in 2009. And there, that's where I realized there's a profession called a sommelier. So I really saw a career progression, and that's where I started to go into wine school.
And you had these friends, colleagues, who I'm sure you became friends because they also had emigrated from Zimbabwe to South Africa and were working in the hospitality business. And you decided to team up all together to compete in the World Blind Wine Tasting Championships, which happened in France.
Yes, so it so happened that we got to South Africa more about the same time, around 2008, and we all started in the same way to learn about wine. Then by 2017, I was working for the best restaurant in South Africa. Tongai was working for the second best restaurant in South Africa. Malvin was working for one of the best hotels in South Africa, and Padon as well was working for a good restaurant. So we had come almost in our tasting and interactions, meeting in these societies, we almost formed a whole group of Zimbabweans, sommeliers in South Africa. And we used to taste quite a lot and relate wine to what we associated with. So when we're being taught about wine in wine school, it was all gooseberry, blackcurrants, blackberries, and none of us ever. I've never seen a blackcurrant tree by now. So it was really difficult, but we discovered, not discovered, but when you realize they're not actually putting strawberries into wine when they're describing strawberries, it's almost association and memory and what you're used to. And when we started associating wines with flavors and fruits we grew up eating in Zim, it was quite much more enjoyable. So we decided to form a team competing in a South African selection. So in 2017, the top 10 wine tasters in South Africa, four of them were Zimbabweans. And, you know, the organizer said, we can help you with the paperwork. You just need to find money. So we formed our team and reached out to Jancis Robinson, MW, who set up a crowd fund for us in London. And we just needed minimum of £6,500. In less than a month, we had raised about £8,200.
Jancis is one of the most famous wine writers in the world. What did her mentorship mean for you?
Yeah, her recognizing us and recognizing our efforts and, yeah, just being mentioned by her already was just a boost and an acknowledgement we're really grateful for. And she also became the instigator of the movie Blind Ambition. She had done a documentary before called Red Obsession. She reached out to one of the producers and said, you've been looking for another follow-up documentary. I think I've got a story for you.
So none of you had ever been to Europe before, and you end up in the Languedoc, I think, part of France, at this tasting. That experience must have been a bit overwhelming for you. How did you do the first time out?
Yeah, I'm not going to be a spoiler for the movie. But like you said, it was most of us, apart from Joseph, it was our first time going to Europe. And for me, we traveled to some vineyards, Burgundy, Mosel in Germany. And for me as a wine scholar, having had read about these regions in book, to really be there and feel the energy and learn about the history there was really, really interesting. And obviously the competition itself, as much as it was daunting, there was always a feeling of togetherness. And even if we're the only all-black team there, it didn't really put us off. And I think we were very welcomed. And that's what I loved about the competition and wine in general.
We won't do a spoiler, but we'll say that you did compete 2 years in a row.
Yes.
Now you're making your own wine. Tell me about that journey.
Yeah, the wine journey, it also ties into me feeling that, you know, the wine language was so Eurocentric in that you always have to describe wine in a certain way and you have to drink wine in a certain way, eat food in a particular way, in a specific space. And I always felt the wine world didn't really reflect my culture, my food, where I consumed wine. There was almost this disconnect. And I felt I needed to come up with a wine brand that really champions inclusiveness in cultures. And I felt I needed to incorporate wine in my own culture. So that's why I named the wine Kumusha. So Kumusha is a Shona word for your roots, your home, and your origins. And I felt there were a lot of people with my background who were intimidated about wine and felt they had to describe wine in gooseberries and blackcurrants. So that was my really motivation to start the brand. And obviously, I have no winemaking background, but I enlisted the help of a good friend of mine who's seventh-generation winemaker at Opstal Wine Farm. His name is Ati. And he was the one who helped me on this project, especially on the winemaking side.
That's so fabulous. It's lovely to have met you. Thank you so much, Tinashe.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure as well.
That was winemaker Tinashe Nyamaduka, originally from Zimbabwe. He produces Chenin Blancs, Sauvignon Blancs, Cabernets, and Rosés, among other varietals, under the label Kumusha Wines. They're available in 31 of these United States, including California. You can also see him in the documentary Blind Ambition, directed by Robert Coe and Warwick Ross. It's now available in select U.S. theaters and via via video on demand, including Apple, Amazon, and anywhere else you can buy movies. Natural wine. What exactly is it? Although less than 1% of the wine produced in California could be classified as such, it has become an influential ethos in vinting and a popular designation with consumers. Documentarian Lori Miller followed a group of California winemakers over a period that included harvests, devastating wildfires, and other challenges. The resulting film is Living Wine. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. What is natural wine? How is it distinct from conventional wine? Or is it easier to say what it isn't?
Well, one thing I learned making the film is that natural wine encompasses so many different styles of wine. So it's hard to really define it. But what I came to learn was a good definition for natural wine was grapes being farmed sustainably, organically, regeneratively, so no chemical inputs in the farming process. And then in the wine production, no intervention, so no chemical additives or stabilizers, all types of techniques that are used in the big California wineries to affect the taste.
So give us an idea of how many additives are often added to wine in traditional winemaking.
So I think it's such a complicated question because I think, for instance, wines in Europe and maybe wines that are made with smaller family wineries, they're not going to use too many, but there are up to 90 legal additives that can be put in wine via the FDA. And a lot of the larger wineries will use multiple types of enzymes or water. Mega Purple is one that they use to change the color. Sometimes it's just sugar or different types of yeast, which is the one that I found the most interesting. It runs the gamut, and it can be one additive, it can be five, it can be 25.
What drew you to the subject enough to commit a couple years of your life following winemakers around?
That is a great question because every documentary does take a couple years at least. And when I first started, I wasn't even sure that I was going to go ahead and make that commitment and spend all that time on it. But I just found the subject matter to be just incredibly rich and interesting. The farther I got into it, it had so many different aspects. I got very, very intrigued by the different farming techniques that each of the winemakers that I followed had come up with.
Did most or all of the winemakers in the film that you followed start out in the conventional wine business? And are they all farmers growing their own grapes?
Yes, I mean, this is one of the interesting distinctions between natural winemakers and conventional winemakers. The natural winemakers both farm their grapes and make their wine. And I learned making the film that in conventional winemaking, the different jobs are separated out. So there might be one person who oversees the farming, another person who oversees the actual winemaking process, another person who does the accounting, another person who does the marketing. And the natural winemakers, they want to oversee every aspect of the wine that they make. And they are self-educated or educated partially through school as well in how to do all these different aspects of the winemaking process. And many of them learn this through interning and working with older, more experienced winemakers. And this is something that we touch on in the film.
Let's start with Gideon. He's the oldest of the winemakers that you follow. And it seems that at this point in his winemaking career, mentoring new winemakers is almost as important to him as making his own wine.
So Gideon Beinstocks is the oldest and most experienced winemaker that we cover in the film. The name of his winery is called Clos Aron, and it's actually named after his wife who works with him, and they make wine together. He is very interested in mentoring a, quote, new generation of winemakers. And every summer he invites interns to come and work with him and learn from him. It's an apprenticeship system. He's produced many, many young natural winemakers.
What's fascinating to me about Gideon is he, at one point in the film, he says, quote, "There is no place for your male ambition here. It's not about the rights and wrongs of winemaking. It's about the place, the vineyard."
Exactly. I'm glad you picked out that line. I was really inspired by Gideon's devotion to wine expressing the place, singularly just being an expression of the terroir, meaning everything that goes into that particular place. It could be the insects, it could be the trees, it could be the soil, it could be the climate. And he is a purist. He's in the film to express this thought, this pure thought of just the wine is going to be the most delicious and interesting and authentic if it simply expresses the place.
Let's talk about Derek, one of the winemakers. He's also a biodynamic farmer who has an extraordinary project that is tangentially related to his winemaking practice, and that is all about mulch. Tell us about him.
So Derek Trowbridge, he's located in Sonoma County. His winery is called Old World Winery. He actually comes from a long line of Italian-American winemakers that live in the area. He grew up drinking wine, and he says in the film he wants to learn to make wine the way his grandfather made it, which is without any intervention. In graduate school, he got very interested in the science of farming, and he spent 20, 25 years developing a special type of mulch that creates a rich and healthy soil biome. One thing I learned making the film is that soil health is important for combating climate change and also important to make great tasting grapes and great tasting food.
The newest winemakers that you followed were Megan and James. Tell us about the two of them.
So Megan Bell and James Jelks, they each have separate companies and separate wineries, but they were very clever to pool their resources to be able to put together a facility where they could make wine. And they're part of a community of young winemakers in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
Did you know going into the film that you would also be covering issues of changing climate?
When I began making the film, I really thought the film was just going to be an exploration about natural wine versus conventional wine. And every time I conducted an interview, each of the winemakers started talking about issues around climate. And I realized that this was a huge part of the story and that we needed to go with it. The ongoing drought, which is, as Gideon says, is devastating his vineyard. His yields are down by more than 50% over the last 20 years. Derek Trowbridge in Sonoma County has been just in the middle of these massive fires for many, many years. And he's come up with all types of techniques to mitigate this. And one of the things he mentions in the film is that the conventional winemakers, they can use sort of products or chemical compounds that they can dump in the fermenting wine if there is, quote, smoke taint on their grapes. But the natural winemakers will not use any chemical products to mitigate the smoke taint.
Thank you so much, Lori.
Thank you so much, Evan. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was Lori Miller, producer-director of Living Wine, a documentary about natural winemakers in California. The film is playing at select film festivals and theaters. It should be available in early November via video on demand. In a minute, two very different shows take us behind the kitchen door. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. In 2021, Elizabeth Ida wowed us with one of the most unexpected children's shows we've ever seen. City of Ghosts is a 6-episode animated Netflix series that follows a team of child sleuths who tromp through various neighborhoods of Los Angeles and encounter supernatural beings. In one episode, a Oaxacan woman finds her missing friend who's died and become a ghost, hanging out at Korean mainstay Soot Bowl Jeep. No wonder adults loved it too. The series recently won a Peabody Award. For her latest project, Elizabeth debuted Mall Stories. It's a short, animated documentary about the people who work at a Mongolian grill restaurant, using their real voices and stories. It's a sweet look at immigrant life and the demands of running a restaurant. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, I'm so happy to be talking to you again.
Me too. We're such enormous fans. And I think for a lot of us, we were really sad that there wasn't a second season of City of Ghosts.
Oh, me too. I was sad, but I'm also, I'm hopeful that the next things that I make can kind of have the same spirit of that, even if it might not be the exact same show.
Let's talk about Mall Stories. It reminded me of a recurring segment that we do here at Good Food called In the Weeds. It's a series that we started doing during the pandemic where we have restaurateurs speak in their own words. I think there's something extremely powerful about just giving people a platform to tell their own stories. Why did you choose that same format for Mall Stories?
As part of thinking about everything going on during pandemic, I had really wondered about this restaurant in the mall that I used to go to a lot. When I worked at Cartoon Network, it was pretty much like right within walking distance. The Burbank Mall was getting renovated before everything shut down. And then I had just been curious how that business was doing, like if they were still going to come back and what their situation was. Also, I was really interested in the dynamic that I would see when I would go to eat there. It kind of seemed like there was a lot more than just they were coworkers.
Did you know them? How did they trust you to tell their story?
I didn't know them personally at all at the Mongolian Grill. I knew one person who would often, when I would order from her and she would look at my credit card, she would notice my last name was Japanese. So she would ask me like a few things in Japanese, but I don't really know that much Japanese. But I was really wondering about her and felt almost like she was my friend because she would recognize me when I would come there.
So the name of the place is Attila the Gorilla in the film. Is that the actual name of the place in the Burbank Mall?
No, I was trying to think about whether to say thankfully no or just no, but they're actually just called like, I think, Mongolian Grill. I chose the name, not being sure if we were allowed to just straight up call it what the grill was, but also just noticing that the other restaurants like these that exist in other places, sometimes they would come up with, to me, like sort of humorous names.
So obviously you got them involved in making it because it's their voices. I would imagine that you had to do extensive interviews with them and then you turned it into a script. Is that what happened?
Yeah. The first step, it's usually finding somebody who will first initiate kind of that contact with the person running that business or the person I want to talk to, because I'm sort of I consider myself sort of a shy person, so it's hard for me to just approach people out of nowhere. And then some of it's like just talking to them to find out their story and trying to figure out how do you aim your interview towards a story that you might have in mind based off of some of the details that they tell you about when they're just telling you about themselves.
You know, a lot of people are talking about The Bear right now.
Oh, yeah.
The show that takes place in a beef sandwich joint in Chicago about how real it feels. And Mall Stories feels equally real, even though the animation style is quite, I don't know, how do you describe your animation style?
I think the design of it is pretty cute and simple, like in kind of like a Japanese video game kind of way. Really simple and charming, not to toot my own horn, but I really like Octonauts. I like watching Octonauts with my kids. So I think there's some similarities to designs in other kids' shows, but ours is a little bit more simplistic.
Yeah. And so there's something about the simplicity of the image with the actual voices of the people talking about their struggle that is sometimes just so humorous and sweet. While at the same time, not being surface. I mean, it's pretty deep.
to me, that's like a really funny juxtaposition. It's always funny to combine a really cute design with like a real person's voice for me.
Tease us with a little bit of their story of the young woman who's basically running the place.
Sure. Minnie's the daughter of the dad who originally bought this restaurant. I think they moved here in the late 90s and then they started the restaurant. And I think it wasn't necessarily like her goal to become the person that runs the restaurant after her dad. I think she had other thoughts, but I guess any family that probably gets into the restaurant business, there's a point where you sort of have to decide if you're going to like help your parents so they can retire and you're going to take that over, or does it end there? It was just a really, for me, like a really interesting insight into like just somebody deciding that they're going to go for it and all of the things that they have to learn how to do in order to run a restaurant.
So if our listeners want to eat at Attila the Gorilla, AKA Mongolian Grill, where do they go?
The actual restaurant is in the Burbank Town Center, which is in like downtown Burbank. It used to be on the top floor, but since the renovation, all the restaurants are in the bottom floor.
So are you going to be working on more mall stories? What's next for you?
I would like to. Through this whole process, we built a whole mall environment and we have sort of these characters that there's another thing you can watch, like a loop of characters in the mall. So it's like 20 or 30 minutes. It's almost like you're just sitting in one place in the mall. So that kind of inspired this thought. Is there other stuff that we can do, like maybe other shorts, but also is there a way we could design this thing so that people could actually hang out in it in VR or even maybe choose the things and the stories that they want to watch or follow somehow in this environment. So I'm hoping that we can try maybe some different stuff, even kind of outside of the realm of making shorts.
How exciting. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth. It's been really great checking in with you again.
Thank you. I'm really happy to speak with you again as well.
That was writer and animator Elizabeth Ito. You'll find a link to her latest project, the short film Mall Stories, on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. I've seen plenty of movies and TV shows set in restaurants. We all have. More often than not, they make me cringe because they are so off base. But I don't think I've ever seen a better depiction of the intense highs and crushing lows of a professional kitchen than what I've seen in The Bear. The show centers on the character of Carmine, Carmi Burzatto, a young acclaimed chef who made a name for himself in New York's top-tier dining scene. We meet him just as he's returned home to Chicago to take over his family's flailing sandwich shop in the wake of his brother's death. Carmi is brilliantly played by actor Jeremy Allen White, probably best known for his role as Philip Lip Gallagher on Shameless. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm so happy to get to talk to you. I mean, I just have so much respect for what you did with the role.
Thank you. And everything you just said was all so nice. And I know your history, so it's a big compliment. Thank you.
I need to know how many beef sandwiches you ate to prepare for the role. To please tell me you're not a vegan.
No. So I'd spent a fair amount of time in Chicago shooting the show Shameless I did previously. And Portillo's was kind of my go-to for Italian beefs. I'd have one or several every time I was there to shoot that show. And then I tried a couple different ones. I probably had about a dozen while I was there shooting The Bear. Yeah.
Do you have a particular order?
Yeah, well, I like spicy and dipped, like wet. Yeah.
So when we meet Carmine, he's hurting.
Yes.
He's mourning his brother. He's having horrific PTSD flashbacks for not only the relationship with his brother, but all the abuse he endured working in restaurants. What drew you to the script and to this particular character?
I mean, I think what you just said was a huge part of it. You know, we're meeting Carmi at his worst, his most confused, his most sort of lost. And so that was really interesting to kind of meet a character going through this most traumatic moment in his life. I was really interested in the culinary world and fine dining. Not that I was incredibly knowledgeable, but I think, you know, a lot of people have a fascination. I think like the amount of people who are interested in that world has grown tremendously in the last decade or two with sort of like the birth of these kind of like celebrity chefs. And so I was interested and I wanted to learn more. And as I did, the world became just more and more interesting. I think for Carmi, my heart just kind of broke for him. His identity was so wrapped up, kind of like everything he's built for himself was wrapped up in his identity of being a chef and being incredibly good at it and successful at it. And his life outside of that seemed pretty empty.
I know that the struggling actor who's waiting tables is a trope. Did you have much experience working in restaurants, either front of the house or back, before you started shooting The Bear?
I didn't. No, I never had any. I started acting pretty young and didn't really have any success until I was older. But I got like a commercial here and there. So no, I had never worked in restaurants. No.
Lucky man.
Yeah.
I understand that you did a fair bit of hands-on prep for the role. You worked at several restaurants, including Pajoli here in Santa Monica. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that experience, how long you were there, and what they had you doing?
Yeah, so I think it all kind of started even before I got to Pajoli. I went to culinary school for 2 weeks at the Institute of Culinary Education in Pasadena. And that was kind of like a crash course. Myself and Io, who plays Sydney on the show, worked with one chef for 2 weeks. So it was kind of like two-on-one. I learned a great deal in that time, really just the basics. I was pretty much clueless in the kitchen before the show came around. So just learning the basics, like how to hold a knife, kind of how to move around the kitchen, when to put oil on the pan, when to heat it, just like really like the basics and simple stuff. And then I started going into restaurants. I spent on and off probably about a month, 5-6 weeks at Pajoli. And it started out being very much like, I wouldn't even call it staging at all. I was really just kind of a fly on the wall. I really just wanted to watch how these cooks moved in the kitchen. And then I began to come during the day for prep where, you know, the margin for error is a little bit smaller. If I screwed up, it could be repaired. You know, I got better with a knife and I just got better gradually. And I was learning a lot really quickly. Everybody there was really supportive. As long as I showed up and I was serious, they seemed game to teach. And then after a couple weeks of that, I was kind of shoved onto the line. Chef Dave Brand, who's a really wonderful chef, he has a place called, or had a place called Dialogue, also in Santa Monica. And he came from Chicago, actually. He was a chef at Alinea for a long time. So he was really wonderful and kind of gave me the nudge. And eventually I was cooking on the line and actually cooking food that was served there, which was a real rush, you know?
Did you connect with that experience? Did you enjoy it at all?
Yeah. I think I gained a lot of respect for cooks and chefs during the process. I don't think I quite understood the sacrifice and the commitment that goes into being a chef, the repetition. It's a craft that, you know, you have to hone so consistently. I think at that level, too, or at any level, you know, serving food is kind of a performance as well. The more I spent time in the kitchen, the more I kind of started to draw parallels between putting together a show or a movie or a play and putting together a meal at a restaurant for your guests. There's performance involved in both. So I think I started to enjoy some parts of existing in the kitchen for the same reasons that I enjoy what I do.
I'm curious about how surprised you were about the internal life of the character the more you got into Carmi. He's such a real depiction of not just a chef owner who's being pushed to the max, but one who's also juggling life problems, which I think is true of everybody in every job, but particularly in the kitchen.
Sure. Carmi has thrown himself so much into his work. And obviously he's been running away from things, his feelings, his family, the place he grew up, long before his brother committed suicide. He's not a stranger to kind of like burying himself in his work. He's so wrapped up in this identity that everything is automatically so high stakes. If he fails, I really think that Carmi thinks he's going to die. And if he can succeed, he'll have glory.
It was really obvious watching The Bear that whoever's writing the show has worked in restaurants. I love the scene where Carmi explains, I think it's to aspiring pastry chef Marcus, how to properly cut a tape label, which is something that Chef Thomas Keller is famously rigorous about. And it's such an insidery thing. Were there other little details like that that you had to pay attention to?
So we had Christopher Storer, who's the creator of our show. He's a really wonderful cook, but I don't know how much actual restaurant experience he's had. But his sister is a really wonderful chef, Courtney Storer, who was chef at John and Vinny's in Los Angeles for a long time. And she was around a lot. We also had Chef Maddie Matheson, who's incredibly knowledgeable now, is a bit more of a restaurateur, but also was a consultant on this for us. But I know that Chris, the creator of our show, a lot of his heroes are our chefs. He has a real passion. That was like a nod to Keller for sure.
Because working in a professional kitchen is so hard, the staff often bonds in a way that people at most jobs don't. A psychologist would probably call it trauma bonding.
Sure.
And I think there's a reason they call the staff dinner family meal. How would you describe Carmi's relationship with his number two, Sydney, played by Ayo Edebiri? She's amazing.
She's incredible. Yeah. There's something really wonderful. They have almost like a instant mutual respect for one another because, you know, Carmi thinks Sydney's talented and Sydney thinks the same of him. But also they come from the same world. And Carmi has found himself at this restaurant where no one else knows. He feels really unseen. And then when Sydney shows up, all of a sudden, I think he feels seen and understood again. And I think, I can't speak for Ayo, but I think Sydney feels a similar way at times. And also very unseen. And I think that's where the conflict can come from. But they've been through a similar ringer. And I think there's a mutual respect and a vulnerability they allow one another.
Well, it's been such a pleasure getting to meet you this way and having a conversation. So much respect for the work all of you have done on the show. I can't wait to see what happens in season two.
Yeah, fingers crossed. It was so nice speaking to you. Thank you so much for having me, really.
That was actor Jeremy Allen White, star of the FX and Hulu series The Bear. Burnout, addiction, an explanation of the classic French brigade system. This is a show that is a total love letter to the pain and joy of being a chef. I highly recommend it. Up next, the practice of saging has gone mainstream, and that has had a devastating impact on white sage, the key ingredient in those popular sage bundles. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Cultural appropriation can do more than make people feel like they've been slapped across the face. It can slap the earth pretty hard, too. Appropriating the practice of smudging is threatening the growth of white sage, a plant revered for thousands of years in native communities. Like organic fruits and vegetables at the farmer's market, there are sustainable ways to purchase and use the plant. Rose Ramirez and Deborah Small shed light on the growing problem in their 20-minute documentary, Saging the World. Welcome to Good Food, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So tell me the range of white sage. Where can we find it? Where does it grow natively?
White sage naturally occurs from probably the farthest north is sparingly up by San Luis Obispo, and down to northern Baja California.
Is it an important species in terms of pollinators and other wildlife?
It's incredibly important to pollinators. It's actually the Latin name for it is Salvia apiana. Apiana means bee, so it really attracts the bees. And it's interesting because although the honeybees will try to pollinate it, they are really not effective. The only ones that are truly effective are the carpenter bees and the large bumblebees, the native bees. It's incredibly important for our native bee population.
How does white sage differ from the sage that we find in the supermarket?
The sage in the supermarket, from my understanding, originally came from Albania and was originally being wild harvested to the point of actually almost destroying its natural existence, and was hybridized and then cultivated for use in cooking and became popular around the world.
How does the white sage plant serve the native community?
Oh, it's so important to the native community, and that's really what we were trying to get across in our documentary, just how deeply and profoundly important it is to the native people. For Nick Rocha, it's a confidant. It's a relative. It's someone who knows his aspirations, his strengths. And for Samantha Morales-Johnson, who's in the film, she said, sage is your friend. It's not your smudge stick. For all of the folks who we interviewed, it's so much more than just a resource for them. They talk a lot about how they have a reciprocal relationship with the plant, how they have a sense of responsibility and obligation and respect towards not only the white sage plant, but all the plants that are so important to them and to the land and to the earth.
Is the plant at this point classified as rare or close to extinction?
No, it has not been identified in any agency structure as a plant of concern. Whereas organizations that deal with native plants have deemed it to be a plant of concern. The only protections are if it grows on public lands, there are laws in place that do not allow for harvesting, picking, gathering of plants on native lands already, except for by tribal people who have those rights in their areas. The poaching that we have discovered has been primarily on those same lands, the public lands. So the damage has been quite severe, particularly in the last maybe 10, 15, 20 years since the rise of the internet and social media, where a lot of the sharing of where it grows and cultural practices used by native people is being shared by non-native people, contorting the actual way native people use it and the reasons native people use it the way they do.
Yeah, one tribal member in the film refers to it as pimping out the blessing, the way sage smudging has become a wellness practice. Can you explain how the native community uses it?
Well, it really depends on the tribe. We found that in northern Baja California, the primary use was funerary. Other uses were medicinal and other ceremonies. You know, north of the border, it really varies. Some tribes don't use it ceremonially. They use it medicinally. Others, it's a primary ceremony plant.
Are there growers, commercial growers of white sage, who native communities feel are doing it well?
There are a few good growers that we know of. One is Sage Wind in Hakumba. I believe it's called the California Sage Company, is also a grower. Mountain Rose Herbs, which is based in Oregon, went from buying wild harvested to growing it, or finding a grower that they approved of. So we've seen that there's a number of them popping up, although not all California Indians who this is their plant feels that way. Many do feel that selling sage is not acceptable at all because it is a sacred plant. The amount of sage that is being stolen, the damage that is being done to the natural habitat is really unbelievable.
The film is just incredibly effective in showing the shocking amount of poaching that's going on. And then the images of native caretakers of the plant and what is left behind is just heartbreaking.
Yes, it is. And I think in the film, it's Ron Goodman, who's a ranger at the North Etiwanda Preserve, and he talks about 15,000 to 20,000 pounds of sage having been poached from the preserve in the last 7 or 8 years. And what's fueling that is the international demand.
So what can we as individuals do to help preserve this plant, white sage?
One of the important things I think we need to look at is, what is the natural environment where your home is? And how can you give something back to that natural environment to make part of your property native habitat? And we highly encourage people to grow native plants, including white sage. It is not only beneficial to the environment, but it is beneficial to us. We can smell the plants, we can enjoy them, we can watch the birds come to them. And if we really need to use them for any reason, we have them there. We're not taking them from public lands and possibly where they're really needed in the environment.
Other things we'd like for people to do is, if they do purchase sage for their personal use, that they only purchase from reputable growers, from regenerative farms, and native plant nurseries.
Thank you so much. It's really a very effective film. I appreciate the two of you coming and talking to us about it. That was Rose Ramirez and Deborah Small, the producers and directors of the award-winning short film, Saging the World. Want to watch it? You can find a link on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. You can also head to cnps.org, the website of the California Native Plant Society, for a link to the film and more information about white sage. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Elena Shatkin, Laurel Garcia, Jillian Ferguson, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Chrissy Van Meter, Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleinman. When I'm not watching movies or TV shows about food, I have to say I'm addicted to British crime shows, both cozy and horrifying. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.